One of my favorite teachings from the Buddha is a compass question that he gives us that says, what when I do it will be for my long-term welfare and happiness? It's a really great question. What when I do it will be for my long-term welfare and happiness? And, you know, certainly we make decisions that are for the short-term and for the long-term and the midway term. But, you know, I think that when we really get close to that, the only thing we, really have choice about is what we do. So I want to really talk about that today. I'm sorry for this monkeying around. I came across this story that I've been carrying around with me for the last few months and reading it in a lot of my classes because, well, you'll see. I like it and I think that there's a lot in it. So if you've heard this from me before, bear with me. Mrs. Jones, a 92-year-old petite, well-poised and proud lady who is fully dressed each morning by 8 o'clock with her hair fashionably coiffed and makeup perfectly applied, even though she's legally blind, moved to a nursing home recently. Her husband of 70 years passed away, making the move necessary. After many hours of waiting patiently in the lobby of the nursing home, she smiled sweetly when told her room was ready. As she maneuvered her walker to the elevator, I provided a visual description of her tiny room, including the eyelet sheets that had been hung on her window. I love it, she stated with the enthusiasm of an 8-year-old having just been presented with a puppy. Mrs. Jones, you haven't even seen the room yet. Just wait. It doesn't have anything to do with it, she replied. Happiness is something you decide on ahead of time. Whether I like my room or not doesn't depend on how the furniture is arranged. It's how I arrange my mind. I already decided to love it. It's a decision I make every morning when I wake up. I have a choice. I can spend the day recounting the difficulty I have with the parts of my body that no longer work, or get out of bed and be thankful for the ones that do. Each day is a gift, and as long as my eyes open, I'll focus on the new day and all the happy memories I've stored away just for this time in my life. She went on to explain, old age is like a bank account. You withdraw from what you've put in. So my advice to you would be to deposit a lot of happiness in the bank account of memories. Thank you all for your part in filling my memory bank. I'm still depositing. And with a smile, she said, remember, there are 5 simple rules to be happy. 1, free your heart from hatred. Free your mind from worries. Live simply, give more, expect less, and enjoy every moment. Isn't that sweet? So what stands out for you of that? Was there something in there that particularly grabbed you? Uh-huh. I already decided to like it. Yeah.
Yeah, and the power of clear intention.
Yeah. Yeah, isn't that true? We set an intention, I'm going to like it. And then what happens is it shifts our outlook completely. Because we could say, I'm not going to like it, right? And then what does that do? That shifts our outlook too. What else did you, what else caught you?
It was the wonderfulness of poetry to express things that can't be expressed any other way.
Yeah, yeah, that too, that's right. Well, I think my favorite line in this is, let me find it. Whether I like my room or not doesn't depend on how the furniture is arranged. It's how I arrange my mind. It's so great, right? So this is what our practice is teaching us, is how to arrange and rearrange our minds. When we notice that it's in a mess, normal, can we tidy it up a little bit? Maybe it's too tidy, not enough breathing room in there, and we need to loosen up a little bit. So how we arrange our mind. And so we don't have to wait till we're blind in 92 to learn to do this. This is the other blessing and gift of our mindfulness practice around choice, is that when we choose to notice the state of our mind every single day or multiple times a day, we have these choice points continually. How do I want to be with this? How do I want to be with this? And, certainly we need to flow and move through our lives without... We can't have continual moment-to-moment awareness that prevents us from actually taking the next step. But we do want to check in all the time. Certainly in transition times of the day, or going into difficulty, or just when we notice we're triggered, or we notice that we're just a little taken away. Huh, what's going on now? How do I want to be with this? Joseph Goldstein's, one of his primary teachers, Munindraji, said, if you want to get to know your own mind, sit down and observe it. Isn't that just great? Just sit down and observe it. So we're very lucky that we have come to this practice to know that when we are actively choosing to sit down and get to know our own minds, it's a courageous thing that we're all doing, to really do this and to do it in community. I love it when Sylvia reminds us of the teaching that she got from one of her teachers, in addition to Joseph, who says, the mind is like tofu. It absorbs the flavor of whatever it's marinating in. And it occurred to me, as I was prepping for today and putting my notes together, maybe that's the whole of the Dharma, that... that the mind is like tofu, it absorbs the flavor of whatever it's marinating in, so choose your marinade, right? Do we want to hang out in difficulty? Well, we know that difficulty naturally happens, but we also understand from the research in neurobiology that we can direct the flavor of our minds by what we continually think about. Right, so the Buddha said, that which one frequently thinks and ponders upon becomes the inclination of the mind. It's true. So really, one of the places that we can make choice is when we notice that we are repeating the narrative of something that's really difficult, that doesn't support us. It doesn't mean that we gloss over difficulty. It just means that we notice when we're on rerun and we're going over it and over it and over it and over it, and that actually doesn't support our well-being. But when we can intentionally shift to, how do I arrange my mind? I already decided to like it. Or when we're in pain and we are in difficulty and we keep telling ourselves the same story over and over again that starts with, I can't believe... and fill in the blank. We all have that, right? You're laughing, right? When we notice that we keep doing that over and over again, check in with your body. Just how is it feeling? How is the breath? How are your interactions with others? How is it coloring your day? So this is what we want to get to know. And we want to do this without judgment, without the blame, with then has all the opinions about our own inner critic about I should or shouldn't do this, all of the judgment. Actually, we just want to know what's going on. Oh, I'm going over and over and over that story. And then, sometimes we have to pound it out with another peg that says, I'm really going to shift gears and think about something else. And then this is the power that we have in the mind, that's inherent in the mind, to bring up from memory something that was really beautiful, something that's really happened wonderful in our lives, and let us hang out in the memory of beauty or joy or love, because it short circuits that repetitive story about na-na-na-na-na, of what I don't like. But because the brain has a negativity bias, familiar with negativity bias, right? We're looking to protect ourselves all the time. There's the tiger behind the bush that's going to come eat me. Because that's natural to the evolution of the brain and how it's wired, we have to work a little bit harder to quiet the negativity, and we have to work a little bit harder to increase the volume of what does support us. And that's what we get out of this practice by just noticing what is happening. So I'll tell you a quick story about how we have these choice points. So Mrs. Jones says, I already love it because I already decided to love it. It's all about how I arrange my mind. In my business life, in Arcata, some of you know I have a laundromat. And it's a big, busy place, and I have about a dozen or so employees, and laundry is a great common denominator, right? We all have it. It's the common experience. And people feel strongly about their laundry, and while, you know, it isn't really about, it's not life and death, we have emotional connection to our clothing. So in this store, we have, every once in a while, people come in and they do their laundry, and sometimes when people leave, they take the clothes out of the wrong dryer and they leave with somebody else's clothing. So you can imagine that's really not cool. And it presents a big problem, and it doesn't happen very often, but sometimes it does. And when it does, we have a system within our store for how do we track and what can we do to help find those clothing, that laundry. Most of the time, people are upset, but they're also understanding, because if they weren't there and attending to their own clothing, that can happen. Even though we are staffed, even though we have systems for tracking, this can happen. So about 2 months ago, it did happen. And the person who lost his clothing was understandably upset. And he was talking to my staff person, who is a man who is quite skilled in customer service and one of the most compassionate, clear, kind people who I've ever had working for us. He really knows how to deal with difficulty, to let this person know they're heard, it's a problem, this is what I'm going to do about it. He's good at that. So this customer came up to him and was upset and was talking about saying, what are you going to do, what are you going to do? And he said to him, this is what I'm going to do, here is our system. And all of a sudden, this customer looked at my employee and slugged him in the mouth. Now, and broke his two bottom front teeth. So sometimes, we get a little overreactive. And this is the point of our mindfulness practice, to know I'm angry, but I don't have to hit you, right? That's the choice point that we're talking about. So then a whole bunch of other consequences occurred with that. And in my role, I need to work with everybody on it, call the police, call the dentist, help my employee. But the other side of that is also to keep in mind what was happening for this person who that was the choice that he made. So it's an opportunity to have some, try to look a little deeper about what is happening for this person. We may not have been able to have prevented the violence that occurred, but the only thing we could do in that moment is manage ourselves, and how are we going to go forward with that. So I bring that up because there's not an obvious answer necessarily, except the practicality of taking care of my employee and dealing with the whole thing. But there are mindfulness programs all over the place now in schools. You know, Andrew knows this. And this is important when we start teaching children that they have a choice about how they manage their frustration and pain and anger. It really does transform us so we don't slug another person. Okay, so that was an arrangement of mind too, right? It's not just arranging it for the positive. We can be, well, I was going to use the word deranged, but I think you understand what I mean by that. I don't know if this is a word, disarranged, but that is what it was like. It is a dysfunction of the arrangement of that thought process. I'm upset, somebody stole my clothes, I'm going to hit somebody. That's what happened. All right, I want to shift a little bit. So in this approach of our well-being, our happiness, I want to think about, is our happiness a choice? Is this sense of well-being, okayness, a choice? Or is it chance? Or is it both? So there's some very interesting work that's being done, specifically from Richie Davidson at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. You might be familiar with him. He's a neuroscientist, and he's been studying the brain in relationship to mindfulness and meditation for probably 40 years. He was one of the very earliest pioneers of looking at what is the neurobiology of meditating and mindfulness. And what I want to share with you a little bit of what he has come up with. What he's concluding is that 50% of our sense of happiness, well-being. I use that word happiness and well-being interchangeably. I don't mean Hallmark giddy happy. I mean this sense that we're okay despite the normal fluctuations of difficulty. That 50% of this comes from our wiring, that our temperament, 50% is we come with a certain temperament. Would you say that? That if you were to think of yourself on a continuum line, over here is ecstatic, over here is despairing. Most of us don't live in those places, but we're somewhere on this continuum with our set point of how we just generally are, what is our temperament. So we have no control of this, the 50% that comes from our genes. It's just how it is. The other 50% is a combination of, one, our circumstances. So maybe our job circumstances, our living circumstances, our internal, our external circumstances. We have some control, but we have some limited control. You know, housing is complex. So, you know, circumstances of our housing influences us. The circumstances of our jobs and with whom we work influences us. So we have limited control about that. But the other part, our attitudes and our actions, we have a lot more agency. And this is the place where we can really affect our lives. And this is where our practice certainly comes in, is to look at what is the attitude of mind, what is the attitude of heart, and what do I want to do with it? This question back to, it's how I arrange my mind, I already decided to like it, or what really is for my long-term welfare and happiness, and to know, how am I right now? Because we that fluctuates all the time, right? The heart, where is the heart in this? Our experience of our emotional lives and the healthiness of our mental lives, our physical being. And so he goes on to say that there are three factors that have greater influence on our increasing happiness that we can do something about. One is the ability to reframe our situation more positively. This is important. And some of us have a propensity for glass half full. Some have the propensity for glass half empty. So that's what we're talking about here. Can we widen our perspective enough to see maybe it isn't all empty, negative? You know, maybe we can just shift our relationship to that. Our ability, the second one is our ability to experience gratitude. Isn't this interesting? the feeling of gratefulness, that experience of gratitude has a very important influence on our capacity to develop increasing well-being in our lives. Because it takes us out of the center of our own story, I think, that when we can feel gratefulness, it opens the heart in such a beautiful way. And the third aspect is making the choice to be kind or generous. That it is a choice. Kindness is a choice. I remember when my children were very little and they were very close in age, that when they would get into a spat, I can remember saying so early on, choose kindness. When you don't know what to do, when you feel really frustrated, choose to be kind. And I think that that comes easier for some than others. And that depends on our wiring. We go back to this place of what is our natural temperament? How do we see the world? So again, the three factors that really influence our ability to develop increasing sense of happiness is to reframe our situation more positively, to feel gratitude, and to choose kindness and generosity. So interestingly, he's gone on. Now, the research hasn't stopped there, but he's gone on to identify four independent circuits in the brain or constituents in the brain that influence our lasting well-being. And I think that this is really where the neuroscience, from the perspective of a meditator, gets extremely valuable, when we start to see that we have some influence on our own wiring in outside of temperament, outside of our genes. So the first circuit that he's identified is our ability to maintain positive states, that positive emotions directly impact our ability to experience happiness. Isn't that interesting? So cultivating and sustaining positive emotions, any amount we can, directly impacts our ability to experience well-being and happiness. And we could say that this is outlook. This is connected to our outlook. The second independent brain circuit is our ability to recover from negative states. So something difficult happens, and we all are somewhere else on the continuum line of resiliency. That's what this is. So something difficult happens, and for some people, we get right up and can manage it and move on. For some people, it's really tough. The same thing can happen, and it might knock us down for days. Are you with me on this? This is really an interesting thing to just for yourself take, map for yourself without judgment, for sure without judgment. Where am I in this continuum of outlook? Where am I in my resiliency? And to know that we actually can develop it and support it. Third independent brain circuit is our ability to focus and avoid mind wandering. So this is our meditation. This is what we are training the mind to stay put. Every single time we come back to the breath or the sensations or the sound or the metta phrases, the mantra, when we hold the mind still, we are developing and supporting and reinforcing this circuit towards being able to pay attention and stability. And interestingly, this piece about avoid mind wandering, I think that there's some caveat in there. What I believe in my understanding about this research about mind wandering is that there's mind wandering that isn't supportive, and there's mind wandering out of which great creativity arises. So do you know the experience of when you're really not thinking about anything and some amazing idea, you get this idea that is really exciting, or some creative process is happening and something comes out of that for you when we're not trying so hard. We're not constricted. We let the mind rest, and that creativity, that inspiration, that insight arises on its own. It feels like it arises on its own because we're not clamped down. That isn't the kind of mind wandering I am understanding this study to show. There's the mind wandering that this is pointing to is that ultra distracted mind that has so much going on it doesn't know where to land. And that kind of mind wandering is it's stressful. It creates anxiety because we're all over the place. So that I want to make that distinction. Because when we go for a walk and the mind is resting and then the beautiful idea comes, oh, my mind was just wandering and there it was. Or we're on the other end of that spectrum where we can't settle because we have it's a room full of baby puppies. You know, they're all over the place and that's the problem. So we're training the mind in that way. So that's a whole circuit in the brain that Richie Davidson has identified as dedicated towards cultivating attention. And the fourth one is an entire circuit that is dedicated to generosity. Now, I think this is one of the most exciting ones. That this is why it feels so good to give. It feels so good to receive. It feels so good to be helpful and kind to others because it's stimulating this circuit that we have in the brain towards well-being. And so what this says about all of these things is that we have some agency here and that this practice that we keep coming back to over and over and over again to steady the mind and connect the heart and come into this intimate experience with who we are is really healthy. It is really supporting us in so many ways in our lives. Do you like this? I think this is really interesting. Another caveat about the research. It's in its infancy. In the research into meditation and mindfulness. And if you compare the studies that are being done in cardiovascular disease or pulmonary disease, thousands upon thousands of studies. In mindfulness, in awareness, we're just in the very beginning. And there's a brand new article out. If any of you read Mindful Magazine, it's called The Magnificent, Mysterious, Wild, Connected, and Interconnected Brain. And it's very long, but it's very worth reading. Yes, it's The Magnificent, Mysterious, Wild, Connected, and Interconnected Brain. And it's an interview that Barry Boyce did, who is the editor-in-chief of Mindful Magazine, with Cliff Sarin, who's a friend of Sylvia's, who's a neuroscientist at UC Davis, and another woman named Amish Jha, and I can't remember where she is, but it's online. It's totally easy to find this. You just go to Mindful Magazine, and it's the May 22nd issue. Inside of there, there was a reference to a Harvard researcher, I think his name is Jeff Lichtman, who is doing brain research at Harvard, and he posed to his students recently, if everything we know about the brain is a mile, how much do you think we know? Any guesses? Not much. So his students said anywhere from a quarter of a mile to three quarters of a mile. And he says 3 inches. Isn't that fascinating? This brain is so, so mysterious and magnificent and interconnected and wild. But I think the hypothesis, the conclusion of the article is really we don't know much. When we think we know a lot, pause, right? But also to understand that the brain is magnificent and it is connected and interconnected to everything in our lives. So how does all of this relate to our Buddhist practice and what the Buddha had to say? Well, I think that the Buddha figured all of this out and didn't need neuroimaging to tell him that when he sat down over and over and over again to observe his own mind and understand how suffering and the end of suffering worked in his own mind and how it manifested in his life, he figured this out by sitting there long enough. And so we're lucky enough to have the teachings that have come down from that, from him. And than to couple it with our Western desires to prove it. But I think my own experience, and I hope it's your experience, that we prove to ourselves the benefit of our practice every single time we sit. Because we do get that sense of steadiness, of balance. Now, it might be that some sits are impossibly painful, that we cannot sit still. The mind is everywhere. But we don't have to make a problem out of it. What we're seeing is it's just like this. This is how it is today. That's it. So from the Dhammapada, the mind, hard to control, flighty, alighting where it wishes, one does well to tame. The disciplined mind brings happiness. The mind, hard to see, subtle, alighting where it wishes, the sage protects. The watched mind brings happiness. Whatever an enemy may do to an enemy, or haters one to another, far worse is the harm from one's own wrongly directed mind. Neither mother nor father nor any relative can do one as much good as one's own well-directed mind. So the flighty mind, the subtle mind, the disciplined mind brings happiness. The watched mind brings happiness. One's own well-directed mind, then the well-directed heart, and our well-directed chosen actions. I think this is what the Buddha is really empowering us with, is showing us how much agency we really have when we have the courage to sit down and see the direction our mind is headed right in this moment. So from about 150 years ago, William James says, the greatest revolution of our generation, so his generation 150 years ago, is the discovery that human beings, by changing the inner attitudes of their minds, can change the outer aspects of their lives. So we keep learning this over and over again from wise people. And it comes from direct experience. It really does. So is happiness a choice? Is it chance? It's nature, it's nurture, it's choice and chance. It's wiring, it's practice. The Dalai Lama says, happiness is not ready-made. It comes from your own actions. So we keep being taught this over and over again. So to take seriously your own actions, what, when you do it, is for your long-term welfare and happiness? How may I be of benefit to my own mind and heart? How does what I do every day really affect my life and the lives of those around me? So, therefore, what we do matters. Let's go back to Mrs. Jones and talk about the five ingredients for cultivating happiness. One, free your heart from hatred. Sometimes maybe that's not so easy to do. When we're triggered, when we're frightened. But thankfully, we have practices that help us do that. We start with mindfulness. What am I aware of right now in this moment? What kind of choices can I make? Oh, this is painful. Oh, I really do have some ill will in there. How does ill will manifest in us? And we want to see that so we can disentangle from this. So our loving kindness practices, our metta practice, this is how we free our heart from hatred. We do it first without judging ourselves for having ill will to begin with. This is natural. This is what happens because we get scared or we feel harmed. And because of the negativity of the bias of the brain, because we're looking out on some very deep way, conscious or unconscious, we're keeping ourselves safe all the time. So in that keeping ourselves safe, we're deciding all the time, I like this, I don't like this, I really don't like this, I really love this. And it's in the I really don't like this where ill will can start to root itself. So we need this practice of loving kindness to wish ourselves well, especially when we don't feel well. The capacity to wish this same care for others, to have compassion for our own pain, to have compassion for the pain of others. And of course, mudita, the ability to feel joy for somebody else's success. We need every single aspect of our practice in order to free our hearts from hatred. We really do. Second one, free your mind from worries. Anybody a worrier? I'm a worrier. I get that. So what's the problem with worrying, right? So what? But we all know that there is a problem with worrying because we start catastrophizing and we start making up stories. We have stories that aren't based in reality. And I love what Shantideva, the 8th century thinker, teacher, said about worrying. And I don't have a direct quote on this, but what he taught was, if we're worrying about something about which we have no control, there's no point in worrying. If we're worrying about something that we actually have some influence over, there's no point in worrying. Isn't that great? So can we free our minds from worry? Live simply is the third injunction. And I think we practice with this all the time. What does that mean to live simply and to recognize actually the complexities of our lives, the natural complexities of living a human life in our current culture, in however our lives are set up? So when we come here to sit together quietly, and all we're doing is sitting together quietly and spending this 2 hours together, it's so simple. And it is so rich, and it is so beautiful. And I think, yeah, every time I go on retreat, or even just have 2 hours or a day, take time out and not have any devices with me, and just have my heart and my breath and my mind and my body, I always feels like this is such a sane way to live. This simplicity, it's so freeing, and it does make me happier. That's really true. It really does support my well-being. So we can look at our choices around consumption. And I don't mean just buying stuff. I mean everything that we take in. How are we unnecessarily complicating our lives? And what can we do to proactively simplify where we can? And to just take that as a practice. It's just a reflection. It's just our own practice. The fourth one, give more. So what I didn't say about living simply is the practice of renunciation. And I love that. What can we let go of? Where can we be restrained in our lives? So when we give more, it's the expression of, I have enough. I am enough. I am secure. I am comfortable in just how I am. It disarms that sense of neediness. Not that it's bad to have needs. Obviously we have needs, so I don't want you to mishear that. But that sense of graspiness, of in order to feel okay, I need to do this, 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 and this. So just watching that in ourselves. How can we give more? And again, you know, the practice of generosity is certainly not all about money by a long shot. It's about our presence. It's about our capacity to be kind to another person, to say hello, to pause, to notice what's happening. Somebody recently told me that she was talking with her teacher of many, many years, talking about generosity. And what he said to her is, this practice is the most generous thing that we can do. And it really moved me because it takes a lot of courage for us to sit here and do this, to quiet our minds, to see what's there. That is a generous thing to do for ourselves because it changes how we behave, how we see the world. We become kinder, I believe. Softer, more open, less judgmental. That's a huge gift to the world. And the last one, Mrs. Jones says, is expect less and enjoy every moment. That would be helpful too. You know, and we do, as human beings, have a fundamental need to be seen, to be recognized, to be loved, to be in relationship, to have connection and belonging. But there's a Tibetan teaching out of the Lojong teachings that says, don't expect applause. Yeah, exactly. Right? So that, where's that fine line between being recognized for who we are as human beings in our lives, but letting that be enough, not needing the adulation, not needing the constant reinforcement? And how can we learn to be able to support ourselves in that way, that I am enough, I have enough, my heart is good, and it is enough. So we need every aspect of our practice, I believe, to accomplish all of this. Free our hearts from hatred, free our minds from worry, live simply, give more, expect less, and certainly enjoy every moment. So we need each other to do this. We need every aspect of our practice to do this. And we do it bit by bit, right? This is a bit by bit experience. So I think I'll pause there. So what do you think? Do you have any questions, comments? Yes, please say your name. Thank you.
So my name is Nancy.
Nancy.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I'm lucky enough to be part of two physician groups that meet and reflect on various topics. And in the last 2 weeks, we've reflected on generosity in both of them. And one of the pieces that I'm really working with is that it's also very generous to accept.
Yeah.
It's a very strong act of generosity on so many levels. It actually, to gracefully accept and to say, wow, so you have something to offer me, instead of us just being like, oh, we have more to give away down there, kind of, but to just be truly appreciative of accepting somebody else's generosity.
I'm so glad that you brought this up, because it is a big deal to not deflect. When we are given, and when we are the recipients of somebody else's kindness and generosity, to say thank you and to actually feel it. And you're right. It is a huge expression of generosity to accept what others have to offer. Does anybody have the experience when you are offered generosity from others of deflecting? Yeah, a collective sigh of, we understand that feeling. So what is it that is in us that deflects receiving generosity? It's a point of practice, of reflection. Am I worth it? Do you actually see me? You see me for my goodness, so you would want to share with me? To take in our own goodness. This is part of our metta practice. Why we wish ourselves well is to train ourselves to believe it, to take in our own goodness. Yes, Nancy.
The other piece that's really strong for me is also accepting our own vulnerability. So not only sometimes receiving, but requesting help. And it's really, really about, accepting humility and vulnerability, which is huge.
It's huge. I'm so glad you're bringing this up. Thank you. Because it makes us vulnerable to ask for help. And it is humbling. But we're giving others the opportunity to help us. Right? So it is generous. Thank you.
Denise, thank you. There's a great book about this topic. It's called The Art of Asking by Amanda Palmer. I don't know if you've read it. And so she's a musician that's basically built her entire career on becoming comfortable with asking and accepting. And she has a TED Talk as well, but I really love her book.
Can you repeat the name of it again, please?
The Art of Asking.
The Art of Asking, Amanda Palmer. Thanks, Denise. Up front here.
Thanks. I'm Jessie. And kind of a different take on what we're talking about is sometimes when people are offering me something, I realize that the most generous thing I could do is to let them give whatever it is to me because they need to give it. And sometimes I find myself kind of, you know, not as open because I might not really need it.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is, if I really look at it, they need to give it. Does that make sense?
Completely. That's right. The Buddha taught that generosity brings joy in three different ways, reliably. One is when we form the intention to give. The other is in the experience of giving. And the other is remembering our giving. But to Jesse's point, and to Nancy's point, about the receiving of it, the receiving of recognizing that we are giving a gift right in that moment by acceptance. And we're accepting that person for who that person is right in that moment, and that the gift is really not about us. I think that's what you're pointing to, Jesse. The gift is not about the thing or about us. It's about the person who is the giver. And when we see that person, that's the coming back to we all need to be seen. That's how the gift goes both ways. Doesn't matter what the item is, right? No. Who else?
Hello, my name is David.
Hi, David.
Hi. I wanted to ask a question just because I read an article yesterday about mindful meditation with children. And you'd mentioned the brain science about, and so it referred to the fact that there's more research and more proven benefits for adults, but that there was still research being done to see about the benefits for children, because obviously their brains are developing differently. Just so you know, too, that we work for an organization, Mindful Life Project, where we bring mindfulness to children in schools. And so I'm really curious about this question about the impact of mindful meditation practice for kids.
What are you seeing?
We're seeing that they're definitely, at least on a surface level, getting the benefits of calmness and attention to breath at the very least. Mm-hmm. And for other kids, much deeper. But I'm also very curious about the effect of children with a lot of layers of trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how, at what, you know, what's the healthiest way to approach it with them in terms of that, without pushing too hard to, you know, because sometimes it's said, too, to be cautious of kids with, that have walls up for safety and the danger of releasing those walls too quickly, because mm-hmm. If you're having to go inward and do that work, mm-hmm. you know, there has to be a safety net as well for the children. So I'm really curious to make sure our intentions are the healthiest for children.
So it takes training to do that.
Right.
So what I would say is that there's a lot of work being done in trauma-informed mindfulness practice. so you know who your audience is. So we don't assume that one practice works, or one set of practices would work for every single child, because it obviously doesn't work for us. We all need different sets of practices, and we come with different backgrounds. So it's important to remember that the brain is plastic, in that it's changeable for our whole lives. And certainly the brains of children are very plastic and are growing and changing at a more rapid rate than an adult's brain. But we can change our brain by training it. And we can change the same thing with children. So what I would say is that people who are teaching children mindfulness, especially children who suffer from trauma, need to have really well-trained teachers. But I would like to actually, Andrew, can I bring you in on this one? Is that okay? Okay, so will you, because I don't teach children, and I'm not an expert on that, so I wonder if you could, both of you, either or, address this a little bit.
Yeah, I really go at it with a sense of play. So I bring in theater, so does the Mindful Life Project, and storytelling, and I really want them to think, when they see me, that they're going to have some fun. Mm-hmm. We're going to sit for a couple of minutes, but that can also be fun. We teach them poems and songs that they can do while they're meditating in their heads, almost like a mantra. And I think the challenge most of the time for me is getting the primary teacher to have some fun, because they can get really reactive really quickly. And it's like, no, 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 do not yell at them to close their eyes, you know. You're killing me here, you know. And you know, you say it, why don't you just sit with us? And, you know, why don't you just sit next to Johnny or Susie, or, you know, and see if just by proximity, you know, that'll change the energy in the room. So
adults are the problem.
often. I don't know if they think that. But, you know, and 'cause it is a process. It's a process for me being in the classroom. Some days I'm more mindful than others. And but it's just not pushing. Mm-hmm. I think that's mm-hmm. the point. JG, you want to say something?
I'll just add that the best practice with any teaching is you create the container of trust, transformative relationship trust, that you know the kids, they know you, a safe space, and that place is unconditionally loving.
Yeah.
Before anything, mindfulness, math, reading. So those three keys, we work with 10,000 kids, and then the 10,000 kids we work with each week in East Bay, 90% of them have severe trauma, right, in different ways. And if we don't do that well, then mindfulness or whatever it is. Yeah. But, yeah, the impact of mindfulness on youth, I'll just say, is beyond amazing. You can't really provide data to show it, right? Same thing with adults.
Well, that was my point about looking at the research and the data, is that the proof is in the pudding. What is happening when we practice? But I really appreciate that you've brought attention to, first, we need to feel safe, right? We need the container to be a place where everybody feels they belong, there's love, that peace is unconditional, that you can bring your whole self. In fact, I think one of the very first retreats that I sat here up the hill, I remember in the if you've sat retreats, you know this experience, that in the first evening or afternoon of retreat, in the taking of the precepts, in agreeing to our guidelines for being together, I remember Larry Yang saying, every one of you is welcome here, and every part of every one of you is welcome here. No part left out. Still gives me chills, because what I thought in that moment is, if that's what they're teaching here, I'm in. And that is, to your point, JG, that's exactly right, that we have to feel safe and welcome, and it's within that we find our way. So important. And this is part of why we do this together, because we are holding each other's hearts in this room. We are. And that is thrilling because we are in this together. We're cultivating the beautiful mind, the beautiful heart. I don't think we can go wrong when we do this. So I'd like us to sit for a few minutes, unless there's any more question that somebody is really burning for. Okay. This is a poem called Happiness from Raymond Carver. So early, it's still almost dark. I'm near the window with coffee and the usual early morning stuff that passes for thought when I see the boy and his friend walking up the road to deliver the newspaper. They wear caps and sweaters, and one boy has a bag over his shoulder. They're so happy, they're not saying anything, these boys. I think if they could, they would take each other's arm. It's early in the morning, and they're doing this thing together. They come on slowly. The sky is taking on light, though the moon still hangs pale over the water. Such beauty that for a minute, death and ambition, even love, doesn't enter into this. Happiness. It comes on unexpectedly. And it goes beyond, really, any early morning talk about it. As we move forward in our day and in our practice, remembering that we sit for those who can't sit, and we walk for those who cannot walk, and we cultivate peace and stillness in our lives for those who have no peace or stillness, and sometimes that includes us. And when it does, to rest assured that others are practicing for our benefit. May all beings everywhere be safe, be peaceful, and come to happiness and the end of their suffering. Thank you all for coming, practicing together today, and such a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.